interview with William Larson, a former member of the Stony Brook Council, at his home in Del Mar, outside of Albany, December 24th, 1989. All right, now I think we have it. All right, Bill. Your name?
William Larson.
And address at the time of your appointment?
I believe it was the year in which I moved to Baldwin, Nassau County, on Long Island.
Your age?
39 at the time, 38 or 39.
And the date of your appointment?
Yes, that was during the year, but I don't remember what month the appointment took place.
But it was 59.
Oh, it was, definitely.
Yes. Who appointed you?
Governor Harriman.
Why were you appointed? What was the occasion?
Well, I think it's fair to say I was appointed as a result of a political process that probably had its beginning when I ran unsuccessfully, I could put in parens, for Congress as a Democratic candidate in the old 3rd Congressional District in 1958, when Governor Harriman, you'll recall, was a candidate for re-election as governor and unsuccessful as well. And I believe that when a vacancy developed on the council, that the governor's office made some inquiries of Democratic people on the island. And, you know, as I'm talking, I see that I'm creating a problem here on timing. I'm talking about 59, but Harriman was out then, wasn't he?
In 59?
Sure. He was in from 54 to 58.
Right.
And then he lost in 58, so he went out in 59.
So well, he was still governor until
January 20th, that goes with the presidential thing. I'm beginning to think, Carl, that my appointment must have come through in 58.
Right.
In which case it was probably toward the end of 58 when I was still governor.
Right.
And then I would have been living in Levittown in the end of 58, okay? And now to your last question, yes. Having been the candidate, I think that when a vacancy arose and inquiries were put forth to the Democratic chairs of Nassau and Suffolk counties, I got a call from the then chair of Nassau, Jack English, asking me if I'd be interested in serving on the council. And having had my name run up earlier on, unsuccessfully, as a possible candidate for the Regents, you know, my mind, my consciousness had been raised in these terms, and I was interested to say yes. And I might say in all candor that this was partly with a view toward whether it might not be helpful in terms of possibly running again for Congress 2 years later. This is the way I think the process played out.
Right. And you were connected in some way with education at the time?
Well, I had been a school board member in Levittown from 50 to 53, and that would have been the extent of it, I would say, if one is looking for relevant background.
Which were the most active members of the council at the time that you joined it?
Well, the ones I remember were those, not necessarily who were the most active, which in looking back 30 years, you know, is something that is shrouded in the mists of memory.
Right.
But I was impressed, I recall, with the fact that the council included such prominent individuals as Ruth Field, Mrs. Marshall, and Harry Van Arsdale, who was head of the Central Labor Council, a very important labor figure. And there might have been one or two others then, but they weren't active, and saw very little of them, and some of them then resigned from the board. Ward Melville was chair, Was anybody conspicuously actively involved in any functioning leadership capacity, say? I don't recall.
Yes. Was Judge Sullivan on it at the time, or was he appointed later?
He might have come on a little later.
I know he succeeded Ward Melville as chairman.
Yes, he did, yeah. But that was some years later, I think. He might have been on it then. He might have been. He was either on it then or came on shortly.
I see. What did you understand were your functions as council member?
Okay, well, I didn't have too much understanding at the time of my appointment because there wasn't any, you know, extensive explanation of what was involved, what would be involved, forthcoming. Didn't work that way. But having served as a school board member and been accustomed to the policy-making functions of a Board of Education, it was my understanding that pretty much the same thing would obtain with respect to the Stony Brook Center of the State University of New York. Not then, but probably during the learning process as a member of the council, I was caused to gain an understanding of the relationship of the council to the central board of trustees and central administration, local administration, and find out indeed that the power and authority of the council is quite limited in terms of major decisions.
Selection of the president.
To be recommended to the board of trustees, right. Which theoretically has a veto power, so even that is a limited power. And approving a budget, which also has to be approved in Albany. So it was to, I think, from those who put the structure of the State University of New York together, the council was probably envisioned as a local group that would be helpful in the development of that particular branch of the university.
Right. Right. How much understanding do you think the other members of the council had of the nature of the university?
Well, it's hard to generalize because I couldn't begin to tell you who were the eight or nine, I don't remember whether we had the full complement or fewer at the time, who they were, much less what their backgrounds were that would give rise to some sense of their understanding of the functions of the university. But backing up a minute, Carl, to my answer to your question of the process by which my appointment took place, and considering that not atypical, it would seem to me that people were brought onto the council without a great regard for what kind of understanding they were going to bring along with them in terms of the way a public institution of higher education would be expected to operate.
All right. Did the council have a hand in the appointment of John Lee, Carl Hartzell, John Toll?
Yes.
All right. In the case of Lee.
I can't remember specifically, Carl, how the role of the council may have differed in regard to the appointment of the three people, the appointments of the three people you're mentioning. As said a moment ago, one of the council's functions was to recruit, identify, decide upon, and recommend to the Board of Trustees an individual for its approval as president of Stony Brook. And it seems to me that we went through that process with Lee and Toll, but in your own case, my memory suggests to me that there was some other procedure possibly followed because you were interiming, I think. But if I'm wrong, it shows you how fuzzy my recollection is.
Well, I know that I joined the system as executive dean in the Albany office immediately on detail down to Stony Brook. And that Harry Porter brought me down and introduced me to a group of the faculty. And as from what I can understand, nobody knew much about me, and that the group of faculty had no veto power over that decision. I was simply brought in.
That accords pretty well with what I would recall to be the situation, because as I said a moment ago, I do not remember that the council was involved in your selection. I think that. Want to cut that just for a second? Hi, Dickie. Yeah, so I don't remember too much about the individual situations, except that I do remember the process taking place whereby Toll was brought in, and I believe it was similar with respect to Lee, but I'm not sure that I was present for the vote at that time. It might have been done at a meeting I was unable to attend.
Well, can you, let's take the Oyster Bay situation first. What do you remember about the Oyster Bay situation and about John Lee?
Well, a very interesting thing developed that opened my mind to a lot that was going on at Oyster Bay that did not come to the attention of the council. And it happened in this way, that John Lee and his wife invited my wife and me to dinner. And I thought that it was probably going to be a social affair with others present. There were no others present, and whether it was intended to be a social with matters of no consequence to the university being discussed, it didn't work out that way, because as I remember, John Lee spent practically the whole time with his wife contributing to the discussion in telling me what an untenable situation he had at Oyster Bay because of his confrontation with Unos. How Olson was doing everything he could to sabotage the Lee presidency, and he detailed this in a fashion that, without some prompting, it's a little hard for me to reconstruct. But let me jump ahead to tell you the counterpart, which was extraordinary. It wasn't very long after that dinner that I had occasion to fly from downstate up to maybe Syracuse. And when I got on the plane and sat down, who should I be sitting next to but Leonard Olson? You can see what's coming.
Yeah.
During that whole flight, I heard from Leonard Olson about what a sorry situation it was at Oyster Bay, and how John Lee had done this and done that, and how Leonard Olson should have been the president, if I'm remembering correctly.
How Leonard Olson should have
Olson. Well, I'm saying that, but if I remember correctly, I have to put a caveat on that. And I'm not sure in these two sessions, or whether it was later that this tension was expressed to me, not just only in terms of the individuals, but in terms of the Chicago influence vis-a-vis the Columbia influence. Two schools of thought, which, if not diametrically opposed, were sharply at odds in terms of the way universities should be structured and operated. So we had these individuals personifying this conflict and this tension. And I was getting over here at the dinner a whole skewed view of things, and over here the opposite, the skewed view of things. You know, very self-servingly positioned. And I thought it was very interesting to hear. As it happened quite coincidentally.
Yeah.
Now, that's partly the answer to your question. Beyond that, I can remember being a little concerned that some of the prominent people on the council stepped off the council. Perhaps it seemed to me, or does in retrospect, that they came onto the council expecting there to be more substance to the role than there proved to be. And maybe some of them felt like, you know, they're wasting their time. Okay? They learned, as I did when they got onto the council, what you could do, what you couldn't do, and maybe found it not sufficiently fulfilling to hang in there for a term, which, as you know, a full term was 9 years, I think, which is a long term. So then others came on, and
so Mrs. Field, for instance, got off.
Well, she did get off. I don't think she served a full term, but she didn't. She was on for a while when I was on, a year or two, maybe.
So what kind of people were they? Can you?
Well, there were some. What kind of people were whom?
The council members, were they able, intelligent?
I think there was a trend over the years to a level, gesturing now, you know, on the high side,
right.
down. Okay, in the course of my years from 59 to 69, which involved a holdover, not to anticipate other questions, but a holdover when I was not offered a reappointment by Rockefeller, understandably, that I thought that the quality of the council members deteriorated significantly. Happens in a political process, but not necessarily. You have appointments made for purely political reasons that have, if anything, just a coincidental connection to quality or potential to contribute and so forth. To some extent, it's a payoff for some, you know, political contribution or whatever somebody made previously. And I think we had some of that. And So I answer you that way, you know, kind of globally, that I saw a less impressive collection of people than there were at the beginning.
Did you do you have any close relations with some members of the faculty during your Oyster Bay days? Tom Irvine?
Ed Feast was on yours. I knew Ed Feast. In Levittown, when his wife was very active in my campaign for Congress in 1958, I got acquainted with Ed. And I remember over at Oyster Bay that Ed was a very prominent guy. He was a mace bearer during one of the first two commencements there, had the title that goes with it, you know. And it seemed to me that Ed was certainly, you know, he was a plank owner there in Stony Brook, one of the originals. And consequently, it was, in having a relationship with Ed, it was always interesting to me to talk to Ed about things that were going on. I think that's the only relationship I had going into it, and I don't recall that I formed any relationships with other faculty people, except as you know, normally would get to know some in the course of various events and functions, going to commencements and so forth and so on.
All right. I have a question here. What were the principal matters of concern during the Oyster Bay days?
Well, this turnover, Carl, that we had there, you know, there are a lot of problems which I think in retrospect you could probably attribute to this, to this Olson-Lee clash, you see.
Right.
I know in terms of organizational dynamics that you can bring somebody in at the top there, you know, but if you have somebody in key positions one level down who's going to try and submarine that person, it's going to be very difficult to be effective as a number one, a leader, okay, the number one leader, if you don't have a dependable secondary support behind you. It's happened in the New York City school system time and again when they brought somebody in from the outside who's been, you know, shot down.
bureaucracy can't move that bureaucracy. Well, we didn't have that kind of a bureaucracy because it was too new and too small. But nevertheless, if you get a key person like a Dean Olson who thinks that the president shouldn't be there, he can certainly do a lot to make sure that presidency isn't going to succeed. And I think that we must have had some problems on the council as a result of this kind of a situation that existed there. Otherwise, we had the practical problems attendant upon a growing institution in a limited physical facility. We had the problem of trying to get the crank turning to pave the way for the move to the permanent campus when the first shovelful wasn't turned over, I don't think, until 62.
No, it's more earlier than that. I think the groundbreaking, the actual groundbreaking, was 60.
60, yeah. I can recall when Rockefeller was out there sitting on the big bulldozer, and we had a luncheon meeting over at the Three Village Inn there, too, in conjunction with that ceremony. Yeah. And I was thinking it was 62, but that could have been 60, sure.
Well, I remember a luncheon at the, I think Rockefeller was out there twice, but I know that there was a speech that he gave in 60 that I'm trying to locate. Norman Hurd was trying to help me find it, but thus far we haven't found it. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea why Ward Melville gave the land?
No, but I do know that he gave it with a view towards something being done with it quite different from what was being done with it. Because in 1958, we had enacted by the Congress the National Defense Education Act, which in the wake of Sputnik was the congressional response to give our science and mathematics education a shot in the arm. And the focus then was to get an emphasis on that kind of training. And my recollection is that Stony Brook was originally envisioned to be a relatively small college of science and engineering. And I think that when Ward Melville was persuaded to, if he was persuaded, I don't suppose he just walked up to somebody and said, hey, I want to give you some land for the university, he was probably approached. And he was approached on that basis. And I think Ward Melville had some problems with it when it turned out it was going to be quite a different situation than had originally been envisioned. And I think the problems he had, of course, was related to his role as the principal father of Stony Brook.
Yes.
And this was going to cause quite a change in the Stony Brook scene, quite a much greater change than had ever been envisioned in the first place. So, I think that Ward Melville probably was asked, I don't know, I would have to...
That I don't know.
You don't either.
Whether, no. Because the first offer from him came in 56. Mm-hmm. And in 57,
okay.
Early in 57, Olson, who was in the central office, was selected as a man to start
right.
The Long Island Center
right.
That fall.
Right.
He had a very short lead time.
Okay. That's before NDEA of 58, obviously, so yeah. Melville is... But I don't think it negates my suggestion to you, because I do have some recollection about this, that what developed was a surprise to him, and it was maybe a lot of other people, including those who originally put Long Island Center on the drawing board.
Right.
I mean, you know, I think this idea of making it a major center, that kind of evolved during the course of our Oyster Bay period.
Yes.
Yeah. I think so.
Do you remember anything about the Heald Report? Heald was...
I remember when you mentioned the name, I remember there was such a report. He was a NYU chancellor, or was he?
He was chairman of the Ford Foundation, president of the Ford Foundation.
Okay, at that time, yeah.
And I think he was probably selected by Rockefeller.
Uh-huh.
I think it was 59.
By the way, one of the reasons some of the people who were on the council and got off the council is they might have thought this was, you know, not going to be any big deal out there in Stony Brook. Had they known this was going to be a major research institution, they might have been more interested to remain involved.
Right.
Speculation.
Do you have any feeling for the extent to which the governors, Harriman and Rockefeller, personally involved themselves in the development of the institution?
Well, I was not myself mindful of what was going on in terms of the Long Island Center, as you referred to it a moment ago, prior to my appointment to the council, and that was when Harriman was practically out the door.
Right, yeah.
So his involvement, I would only have been made aware of kind of retrospectively, and I don't have any remembrance now that he was notably concerned as an individual with it, but that's just a vague feeling on my part, whereas it seems to me that Rockefeller maybe demonstrated a more aggressive interest in the development of the institution. Maybe.
Did you know Carlino?
Acquainted, yeah. Certainly knew him to be until he was defeated in about 64, I think, one of the major Republican powers in the state legislature, as the majority leader of the assembly, I think he was. Yeah.
Oh, in the assembly?
Yeah, majority leader.
Yeah.
Or speaker, maybe. Maybe speaker.
Right.
Why do you ask?
He's a shadowy figure. Very few people mention him.
Okay.
And yet he was a powerful individual during the Oyster Bay days.
Yes, he was.
But he doesn't seem to play much of a role.
No, I have no recollection of being aware of his role at that time, if there was one.
Okay. Did you have any contact with, besides Olson and Lee, Hamilton?
Who's Hamilton?
Hamilton was the then called the president of the SUNY system. He was Tom Hamilton. He was the one who appointed me, actually, and who put Porter in charge of the campus after Lee resignation, I guess.
So Hamilton was head of the administration centrally?
Yeah, central.
Was
central.
He the first?
No. You had, a man who was one of the top administrators of the Ford Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
His name slips me, I think.
Okay.
Was one. Carlson was one. Prior to Hamilton.
Okay.
Then Hamilton. And Porter was sent down. Hamilton thought that he could run Stony Brook from Albany.
I see. With a man, with his man in charge.
Yes. With Porter.
Okay. I don't recall contact with Hamilton.
Right. Remember any contact with Porter?
No.
With Harry Porter?
No.
He was provost in the central office.
Something might come back if we work this over for a while, because when you mention these are names that have long since slipped out of my mind, and little bells begin to tinkle, but it's not easy to bring it back, because we're talking about 30, 25 years ago. Harry Porter, sure, I remember Harry Porter. I think we had, the council would have had contact with him, and he's down there filling in after
leave. But, you know, the sequence eludes me a little bit, you know, in terms of the heads of Stony Brook.
Okay.
I mean, from Lee to Toll, we've got, you know, a space in there.
Yes.
With several people coming into play.
Well, about me. I came September of 62, which was the year of the move to Stony Brook. And the only department that stayed that year in Oyster Bay was biology. Now, do you have any feeling for what I did, the way I handled things for 3 years?
No, my feeling is that you were a calming influence in a situation where there had been a great deal of turbulence prior to your arrival.
Okay.
I don't recall that we had on the council any controversy involving your function.
Yes, as far as I know, you didn't. I know that Ward Melville, time and wish that I would stay in charge. I got along well with Bill Sullivan. He was a very good person to handle the council.
I used to see something of him because we commuted a little bit. We traveled together some back and forth to the meetings. He was coming from Rockville Center,
yes,
next door to Baldwin's.
Right.
So while I didn't know Sullivan, even though his appointment was presumably comparable to mine in terms of the Democratic political big D process there,
right. He was chairman of the council.
Well, he was when Melville left, but I'm just talking about how he got on the council in the first place.
Right.
I don't know what his background was that would have necessarily made him a logical candidate. But mind you, I don't think you need professional education experience to qualify for the council any more than you do for a school board. I don't believe that. We're talking about a lay body of people who can think, be objective, imply some intelligence to arrive at a decision and go through a decision-making process and do other things related to having an institution that works well.
Okay.
So Sullivan was okay.
You have no idea who appointed me or how I happened to get there.
I probably knew it at the time.
But you can't remember.
No.
Right.
I think that I think it was a process that took place up in Albany. I don't think that the council was involved, as I said earlier. I said that it was kind of I thought of it, you know, as an interim kind of thing. Maybe there was a given to the council was given to understand that between president here and president somewhere down the road, we now have an acting head of Stony Brook, namely Carl Martell, coming out of Albany.
Until they could find a president.
Yeah. Yeah. Have to have somebody who's handling the tiller.
Right. It was supposed to be a one-year appointment.
Yeah.
I was supposed to go back to Albany.
Okay. If that squares with what I would have situation.
Do you have any impression of my strong points or weak points?
Hmm.
Try to be as objective as possible on this, because one of my problems is...
Sure, it's a problem. When you're being interviewed by somebody, it's very difficult to be objective, you know. But I don't. My greater difficulty is recall.
Yes.
I would. I referred earlier to a calming influence. You know, I think we've been going through a difficult period there. And I think I don't even remember the circumstances of Lee's ouster. I don't recall that the council decided Lee had to go.
No, I'm sure it didn't.
Right. I think it was
kind of Hamilton.
Yeah, and maybe that's related to the Olson Lee.
Board of Trustees.
And the Board of Trustees.
Do you know anybody on the board?
No.
The Board of Trustees?
I think not.
Frank Moore or Warren?
Who? Warren?
Warren was vice chair.
Yeah. I don't think I would have known anybody then. Later on, I had some board members. I don't recall knowing any at that time. No, I can't give you a detail, Carl. I'm not fudging it in terms of your strong and weak points. I don't remember that the council passed a resolution. They may have done it. I don't remember that the council passed a resolution urging the Board of Trustees urging you in the first place to accept a permanent appointment, and then urging the board in the second place to make it. But I don't know why they wouldn't have. I think one thing, the fact that you were there for a second and a third and a fourth year was not because, the board was unable to avoid that. The council was unable to avoid that. I think the council was pleased. It was the situation was significantly improved from what it had been. Which isn't to say that I think that Lee was all bad and Olson was all good, or vice versa.
Right.
But it wasn't helping.
Well, now, let's talk about the problems that the Stony Brook administration faced. Architecture, construction, community relations, student life on a construction site, dormitories, the social background of the students, their behavior, faculty and curriculum divisions, and so on, that kind of thing. You indicated some unhappiness with the architecture.
I did.
I think Ward Melrose unhappiness with the architecture.
Well, no, I would have some sense about that, but I didn't refer to that earlier. I referred to Ward Melrose perhaps being quite surprised to have a tiger by the tail instead of a doe, because.
Right.
Instead of a little Stony Brook, it was going to be who knows how big a Stony Brook. So, but when it comes to architecture, I think Ward was caught between a rock and a hard place. After all, he is the one who was credited with having fashioned the village of Stony Brook into its uniquely, whatever it is, colonial style. And I think he would have envisioned something that was compatible with that. And instead of that, we had something that looked like, typically, like... institutional New York, whether it was a prison or a university, essentially the same. Very severe brick.
Public works.
And with no control locally.
The
impotence of the council. Here's Ward Melville, gives them the property without which they wouldn't be there, and nevertheless has to come to terms with the fact that he hadn't got a damn thing to say about what's going to be done with it.
The architects, Flores, Walker, Smith, and Haynes, were the architects of for the telephone company.
They claim to fame. I don't see any reason why you can't have enough flexibility and imagination and common sense in the administration of State University to be able to do something over here and something over here. If you could do this style that you have in Albany here, notably different from Binghamton or Buffalo or Stony Brook. I don't see why Stony Brook couldn't have been designed to fit.
I think
plenty of models.
I think one of the reasons is though that the concept of Stony Brook evolved during the period when they had to build something. And they had to build buildings, and the concept of the nature of the institution was not fully formed at that time.
Fair enough. It certainly wasn't fully formed, no. This just kept evolving and evolving. It was growing like Topsy without a clear conception of where you're going with it,
right.
Either in terms of its academic emphasis, in terms of its size, in terms of its research focus.
Do you remember anything about the actual appointment of John told about the council's making a decision that Toll was going to be the person to recommend to Gould?
I think I missed the meeting when Toll, when the council decided upon Toll. I think I was, you know, maybe the meeting when they interviewed Toll.
Minutes would show that, obviously.
So I don't really remember very much about.
As far as I know, they never did interview Toll.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I didn't miss any meeting. Oh, my goodness, how could that be?
Well,
because we have a search committee who would interview 85 people and recommended them to the council, and then we just looked at his credentials, and then we already knew that the board of trustees was going to appoint him whether we wanted him or not, right?
Well, I remember Bill Sullivan asking me if I thought Toll would make a good president.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I thought so, yes. And then he asked me, would you go down and interview him to see if he's interested in the job?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, all right. So I went down and interviewed him. Stayed overnight in his home at breakfast with him. And then he asked me, why aren't you interested in the job? Or asked me if I was interested in the job. And I said I was not. Because after 3 years, I had had enough of administrative problems that did not relate to the teaching and curricular aspects. My experience was for 10 years as dean of a college and then dean of a university. And at Stony Brook, I was involved across the board with financing, police, students, all the rest of
all the logistical stuff, yeah.
I wasn't interested in
that. No, I can understand that. That'd be good. That would be a response that would be fairly neutral, not to turn off a prospective candidate, like saying, can't stand the counselor, I can't stand the faculty, or anything like that. But why did Sullivan, what made him know that, what made him interested in Toll as a possible candidate?
We had interviewed him on the recommendation of Alec Pond for the dean of the graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
We had a line. We had a line that was vacant. And well, we had in the past a couple of deans of graduate work. At the time that I was there, they were acting, and I wanted to get somebody in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think John Toll was nice in that job.
But that's how he came to our attention.
But, yes, but his name came up gradually.
I think it's very interesting, by the way, that Sullivan would have undertaken to arrange an interview with Toll, and I have no recollection whatsoever of having ever been aware of his having done that. And I would raise a question which would go to council operations as to whether it's appropriate for the chair of the council to undertake unilaterally to do something like this. If indeed it was done unilaterally without reference to the council for a green light, questionable procedure.
As far as I know, I attended every meeting of the council. I don't think there was anything done which I, behind my back. I think Bill wanted to make sure that I was not going to sabotage anything. And the key question was, would you put that on an interview?
Not a bad idea. I just think the council should have been doing it. Maybe it was.
That I don't know. You were.
No.
And I haven't interviewed anybody else on the council. So
the minutes should show, though. The minutes should show whether or not the council authorized the chair to have a representative go down and interview Tom.
And I don't know where the minutes of the council are.
Oh.
So that's one thing I've got to find out.
Oh, boy, I don't think so. That'd be a load of history there. That's the legal record of
Johnny came out and stayed with Ann and me at Planet Cures.
Yeah.
And I briefed him for 8 hours on the kind of people he was going to find in the central office, on the structure of the state system.
Right.
And the needs of Stony Brook.
Yeah, it was a job to you then, I would say. Because you need to know those things.
Yes. Who would have done for you then? And Sullivan finally wrote a letter to Gould saying, don't look elsewhere until you have looked at John Sullivan. And Johnny went up and talked, and they talked, and Gould was, Johnny was all right as far as Gould was concerned. So that was
that. I remember being surprised that we had a physicist coming in to head up the institution.
Brilliant.
Yes. That was probably a personal bias of mine, I suppose. Perhaps.
Well, I think he and Alec were very good friends, and nobody said it all.
Oh, and I think so, yeah.
Alec had a good...
And it was not inconsistent with what seemed to be the direction in which the focus of the university was going, you know.
Right. All right. I'd like to...